You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. If you're on the fence about life insurance, get down with Ladder. Ladder is the smart, easy way to get and manage life insurance. Just go online and apply. It only takes a few minutes. With Ladder, there's no paperwork or fees, and you can change it anytime without penalties. Ladder is licensed and backed by trusted partners with billions in coverage. Go to ladderlife.com and get off the fence about getting life insurance. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Folks, is it just me, or has our political discourse in this country gotten way uglier and more personal? We've certainly had some down-and-dirty elections over the years, going all the way back to Jefferson versus Adams, so maybe American politics is no worse than it's always been. But man, doesn't it make you feel gross? I can't tell you how often my news feed sends my blood pressure through the roof, the latest Trump tweet bums me out, or I dread a heated argument when I hang out with a friend who happens to be on the other side. It really wasn't that long ago that Americans on both sides of the political spectrum could have productive, civilized discussions about policy and the direction of the country without resorting to name-calling or bridge-burning. There really ought to be a better way to explore our differences. That's the goal of a new podcast called The Arthur Brooks Show. Arthur Brooks is the president of the American Enterprise Institute, and he's dedicated a good deal of his life to fostering better political discourse. His new podcast explores what he calls the art of disagreement. And today, Arthur joins me on the show to talk about just how things got so damned ugly and how to fix it. He says the answer isn't to stop talking to each other, it's to talk better to each other. If that sounds like couples therapy, it's not that far off. And Arthur reveals what one of the country's leading marriage counselors recommends for better communication between the right and the left. Arthur describes how social media lowers our inhibitions and makes us meaner. He discusses Americans' addiction to moral outrage as a form of virtue signaling and points to studies that prove that a positive act of kindness says far more about a person's goodness than shaming someone on Facebook. He talks about the science of persuasion and how we change our minds, why people take politics so personally, and how contemptuous political debates can actually have a negative impact on our health and even lower our immune system. But he says if all else fails, try taking a 2-week vacation from politics. I know, easier said than done. All that and more coming up with Arthur Brooks in just a moment. Arthur Brooks is a best-selling author, a social scientist, and the president of the American Enterprise Institute. He's recently launched a new podcast called The Arthur Brooks Show, and I'm happy to welcome him back to the podcast. Arthur, thanks for talking with me.
Hey, Ben, how are you?
I'm fantastic. It seems like there's been a lot of water under the bridge. What a difference a couple of years make.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, the biggest thing is that I have a little podcast that has sort of an artisanal thing with, you know, a few hundred thousand subscribers. You have millions and millions of people listening to you. Congratulations.
Somewhere it's making a dent, I hope. Well, when last we spoke, it was early in the GOP primary. I don't think that you or I ever would have predicted that Donald Trump was going to run away with the Republican nomination. And at the time, you were talking about this wonderful book you had written called The Conservative Heart. In that book, you appealed for a more empathetic and welcoming form of conservatism. Here we are, well into the Trump presidency, and a large swath of the conservative movement, it seems, now identifies with white nationalism, isolationism, protective tariffs, the separation of immigrant families, turning away refugees. Does it feel like your ideas in that book fell on deaf ears?
Yeah, sometimes. But on the other hand, I don't think that characterization of ordinary conservatives is quite accurate. Those are some policies that the Trump administration is undertaking. But most people are actually not thinking very much about, you know, what their broader meta philosophy is. And you know, they voted for Donald Trump largely for two reasons. When we look at the data, the reason that ordinary people voted for Donald Trump by the millions is, number one, he wasn't Hillary Clinton, which was big. And number two, they felt like they were sort of being lied to and forgotten, and they wanted somebody who was going to fight back. Now, you see in most of the data that most Americans don't really approve of his character. They don't approve of a lot of his statements or sort of the pugilism of the way he uses social media. But on the other hand, Americans are willing to give him a chance. And so at this point, a lot of people are giving Donald Trump a chance.
Now, is there a way that the kinder, gentler, for lack of a better word, conservatism that you advocate can coexist or work within the framework of the Trump agenda?
Well, that's, as we in social science like to say, an empirical question. I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life to the movement, to the movement of that brought me into the conservative sphere in the first place, which was to push opportunity out to people who need it the most, was for the radical equality of human dignity. Now, that doesn't mean that it's going to be equally popular with all people at all times, but I think that actually that's where the American heart is, not just the conservative heart. I think that's how, you know, most people feel about it. I see public opinion data that tell me that, you know, about 70% of Americans don't hate their neighbors and don't want to be told to hate their neighbors. So I think that we're kind of in a funny political disequilibrium right now. It makes sense, given the fact that we have this bad, uneven recovery from the financial crisis that left so many people out. But I think at the end of the day, when we have more aspirational leaders that are talking about trying to include everybody in prosperity and loving our neighbors and being more flexible in the way that we see things, I think that ultimately is what ordinarily wins out in America, and I think it's what's going to win out in America again.
And one interesting thing that your organization, the American Enterprise Institute, is doing to address the concerns of those who may have felt left behind or disaffected is you started a project about human dignity. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I love this project, the Human Dignity Project, because it's different than anything we've done before at AEI. And that I'm aware of, it's different than on anything on the political right. And the whole idea is some people like President Trump and some people don't, but nobody really likes the circumstances that led to the current political climate. Most people don't like the fighting and the contempt and the hatred, but they understand, you know, what led to that current moment. And if we want to make things better, no matter what our politics are, we have to address the root of the problem. And the root of the problem is an economy of despair, where too many Americans feel like the American economy and prosperity and progress has really left them behind. And they're not wrong, by the way. And so the Human Dignity Project looks at a bunch of angles of despair. It starts off with the fact that we have a really low unemployment rate, but we have a ton of people who are still out of the workforce, particularly men. You know, how can it be that so many people coexist outside the workforce with so much demand for labor? And the answer is people don't have skills. We have a skills needs mismatch. We have this crazy college for all mentality, a classism and elitism in our society that shouldn't be. I mean, there are all kinds of people that can add so many important things to our economy, but they need more skills. Everybody coming out of high school needs more skills, and people need to be retrained as well. So a big part of what we're doing is vocational and technical training, career and technical work, the idea of apprenticeships all over the country, trying to push people to trade schools, if that's appropriate, as opposed to a college education that they'll find pretty unedifying. And, you know, altogether, I think that we can find solutions to these problems that can use the current moment as an opportunity, as opposed to just a threat.
And you've also, in the Conservative Heart and in other writings, made an impassioned case for a conservative solution to help the people at the very bottom rung. I suppose your partner on the legislative side has been Speaker Paul Ryan, who's been an advocate for a conservative solution to help end poverty. But we hear less and less about this from him. And of course, he's now retiring. Does the dream of a conservative war on poverty die with Speaker Ryan's retirement, or who picks up the ball from here?
I see a lot of people, particularly in the Senate. Two-thirds of the senators who are under 50 are Republicans, and a lot of them are very reform-oriented. So I hear Ben Sasse talking a lot about a really compassionate case for why the conservative movement should be about people, primarily those in the bottom quintile of income distribution. Tim Scott from South Carolina is phenomenal on this. James Lankford from Oklahoma. Mike Lee from Utah. I mean, all these guys are talking about the new kinds of policies that help to end discrimination, that will help to lift people up, that will give more people more opportunities. And, you know, what we all have in common, I think, because these are all guys, by the way, who are my age, who came of age when, you know, we were kids, or in high school, in my case, when Reagan was president. And, you know, the thing that we saw was that the conservative movement was attractive because it was so optimistic and it was so oriented toward the original intent of the founders. I mean, the founders were a bunch of rich guys, but they were creating the American system. They were writing the founding documents, not on behalf of landed gentry, but rather on behalf of ambitious riffraff. Immigrants, people who had nothing, people who had run away from the blood and soil kind of altar and throne nonsense that would hold them down in Europe. We're an incredibly progressive nation, and American conservatism at its core is a progressive ideology. It just uses these traditionally conservative means to get these universal results. So I came into the conservative movement because I'm a progressive, and that's certainly true in the case of Paul Ryan, but also in the case of the senators I just mentioned.
You've consistently called for a more civilized discussion of policy based more on ideas than emotion. So this latest project is a very logical and timely extension of that. As I mentioned earlier, you recently launched this terrific new podcast, The Arthur Brooks Show. Specifically, you say, to explore the art of disagreement. Now, that makes me think of the famous Bill Buckley quote, "We can disagree without being disagreeable." Do you think that's still the case, or is the art of disagreement becoming something of a lost art?
Yeah, no, it's a question that I'm exploring in this podcast. The first season is 8 episodes, and these all 8 of these episodes are on different aspects on disagreement. And the core thing to remember is that, you know, there's a tendency to say when disagreement is so bitter and disagreeable, unpleasant, that disagreement's a problem. We need more people to agree. That's actually wrong. The heart of excellence in America is competition. You know, competition in economics, competition in politics. You want contested elections. You want fierce competition among corporations. And you want fierce competition in ideas as well. Competition per se is actually what we call disagreement. The problem is that a lot of what we're doing today is actually not competition in the war of ideas. It's basically shutting the competition down in ad hominem argumentation and personal attack. It's basically the equivalent of, in sports, trying to blow up the bus of the other team on the way to the game. That's not competition. That's exactly the opposite of it. And that's what we need to do better. Yeah. So Bill Buckley, the great one, was right when he said we need to disagree without being disagreeable. What we actually need is to disagree with each other and still love each other.
And that gets to, I think, something you discuss in your first episode. You actually recall being a young man in your 20s and starting to form your own political opinions that diverged from those in your family, specifically how it made for an awkward Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah.
Now, I think everyone listening can probably relate to that, and they've been in that position. And for many people, the solution is simply to avoid the topic of politics altogether with family. How did you handle that dilemma?
Well, so the way that the story went was actually it was around Christmas time, and I was in my late 20s. And I grew up in a very traditionally progressive home in Seattle, Washington, which is basically all homes in Seattle, Washington, or virtually all of them. And you know, my parents weren't overly political, but, you know, they had the more or less the conventional political views of the place and time. And And I was experimenting with capitalism, as it were. It sounds like I was experimenting with drugs, but you get the idea. I was thinking about free enterprise. I was thinking about conservative ideas for the first time. And my mom and I were cooking in the kitchen, and she says, she's real quiet and being really weird. I said, "What's on your mind?" She says, "Well, you know, your dad and I are really worried about you." I said, "Well, what is it?" She says, "Have you been voting for Republicans?" And it was this, this moment of, you know, tension. And you know, it turned out really never to be a problem. I mean, the people in my family disagree with me politically, but the things that we have in common is, you know, our Christian faith and our the way that we want to raise our kids and the love that we have for each other. And, you know, that stuff is so much more important. Politics is just like, you know, ninth on the list. And the truth is, when I meet somebody, I don't care who they are, politics is not the thing that's on my mind. Like, I'm the president of the American Enterprise Institute. I'm in the center of Washington, D.C., in the middle of these big battles. You'd think that I would be an obsessive about political ideology. I'm not. I'm a, you know, flesh and blood. And my heart is supposed to be full of love. That's not just what I'm commanded. That's what I want. And that's what everybody wants. And so the key thing is remembering the proper place of politics. And that's how you can adjudicate this as well. You know, hold your opinions. Hold them high. Hold them with pride if you want. But the key thing, if you love other people, is to remember you need to listen to other people, not just tolerant and not just civil, because tolerance is a stupid standard. Tolerance is like, you know, yeah, my wife and I, we tolerate each other. You're about to get divorced. You know, civility is a stupid standard. The idea I will be, you know, kind of the simmering civility between people. No, love is the right standard. You know, you need to love your neighbors and you need to love everybody around you. We owe that to each other. And furthermore, you know, it's interesting. You know, I talk to diverse groups. I do about 175 speeches a year, so I'm constantly on the road. And when I'm talking about these issues, I'll say, like, I want a quick show of hands. How many of you, and so we'll have a quick show of hands for people who are listening to this podcast. How many of you love somebody with whom you disagree politically? It's every hand. It should be every hand. If it's not every hand, you got to get out. If you know, your hand didn't go up, you got to get out more. And so if that's the case, if you love somebody with whom you disagree, then disagreement's no problem. Disagreement shouldn't be any problem. You should listen to each other and go, huh, that's an interesting perspective, which I may or may not share. And, you know, if I'm wrong, I want to know first. And I want people that I love to fill me in on what they're thinking. It's more of an interesting, better life.
But it does seem to me that I'm running into more people who say things like, I would never date someone on the opposite side of the political spectrum, or you know, I'm seeing people who have ended entire friendships over politics. It seems like that type of fractionalism is increasing at the personal level.
Sure is. You know, there's a Pew Research Organization survey that just came out that shows that about 1 in 6 Americans has either ended a relationship with a family member or a close friend because of political differences. And that's just crazy. My view on that is that that's the deleterious impact of what we around AEI we often call the outrage industrial complex. There are major commercial forces in this country that are dedicated to people hating each other. They're trying to pit American against American because that, man, that is super profitable. You get ratings, you get you know, commercial endorsements, you can get a big following by being outrageous and peddling hate. And you know, some people are going to fall for it. That's one reason. Mm-hmm. Another reason, of course, is the anonymity that comes from social media and our ability to silo ourselves. And so the result of that is that we're not keeping our priorities in perspective. Human love and relationships is way more important than these political differences. And so when I hear a young person, and I'm around a lot of young people, here at AEI, a big part of our workforce, when I hear a young person saying, I would never date a liberal, I say, are you kidding me? That's nuts. I understand that there's some values differences that could actually be an impediment in a relationship. But the idea of foreclosing a relationship with somebody who thinks differently than you is basically like saying, I'm only going to eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for the rest of my life. That's stupid.
But, you know, the problem is I run into a lot of people both on the right and the left who say that they've just given up talking to the other side because their attitude is, why waste my breath? Everyone is dug in their heels at this point and you're never going to change anyone's mind. So why bother? Do they have a point? I mean, it takes two people to communicate. So if the receiving side is unreceptive, what can you do? What is the point?
Well, part of it is managing our own expectations about what we're trying to do when we discuss contentious points of view. You know, there are people out there who are true believers to your cause and they agree with you. And everything you say, they go, yeah, I agree. Well, that's actually kind of boring. There are people who are actually open to different points of view. And when you're being contentious and obnoxious and bitter and insulting, you're going to drive them away. You want to talk about, motivate your points of view with respect to how they bring greater love into other people's lives, how they lift up people who have less than you, how you can serve other people. I mean, in other words, when you have a winsome way of explaining your point of view, those who are actually open to persuasion might be persuaded. But you're really talking about, you know, giving up on talking to the hostiles, the people who are have really the opposite point of view. Well, the objective of talking to people who are hostile to your point of view shouldn't be, you know, at the end of 30 minutes, I presented you with so many facts that you go, you know what? You're right. I am an idiot. You know, it's not plausible. It's just nobody in history has ever been insulted into agreement. Your objective should be to soften the opposition, to get people to think in a slightly different way, and to find the common moral objectives that we have. And in doing that, you'll deepen relationships. You'll make people, you know, improve their own points of view, and you'll help them to understand you a little bit better. That's what we ought to be doing when we're talking to people who really, really disagree with us, as opposed to saying, you know, Matt, I'm going to argue at them as hard as I possibly can, but look, if they're so, you know, bullheaded that they're not going to come to my point of view, I'm just not going to bother anymore. Well, you're basically doing it wrong.
Well, let me ask you this then. You know, it's one thing for two well-informed intellectuals to have a serious debate about real policy, but more than ever, the political discussion these days seems to be dominated by blatant and objective misinformation, disinformation, and paranoia. How do you address conspiracy theorists in a civilized and respectful way without conferring equal weight and legitimacy on arguments that are frankly just outright nonsense?
Yeah. This is the fake news problem, right? You didn't say it, but let's get it out there. I mean, the idea that there's a bunch of misinformation out there that's being propagated largely on social media, that the reason that we have so much misinformation is not a vast conspiracy of the Russians, although, you know, you don't rule anything out these days. The reason that we have so much of this is precisely because of siloing. And when people don't hear another point of view, they tend to radicalize themselves and to believe any sort of crazy thing about the motives of others. And that metastasizes into, you know, if you will believe, if you're only talking to people who agree with you and who are more radical than you, and you're watching television and reading publications that push you to your greatest amount of anger, you'll start to attribute the worst motives to people who disagree with you. This is something that psychologists on my podcast have talked about with great frequency. And from there, when you have attributed the worst motives to your interlocutor, you'll start thinking that they will do worse things than they actually would. You know, you'll have the Pizzagate and all kinds of crazy stuff that's flying around the internet on right and left. You say, how could somebody believe some nonsense like that? And the answer is because they're just not getting out of the house. They're not talking to enough people. So that's what we actually need to do. We need to expose ourselves and expose other people systematically to what they consider to be ideological pathogens. That makes them stronger. It makes their resistance stronger. It makes their argument stronger. And it gives them a much, much better sense of the reality of what's going on. So I say, you know, it's crazy. There's another Pew study. These guys at Pew do such great work. And it was a study that asked about perceptions and realities of the other side. So, for example, it asked liberals, what percentage of conservatives earn more than $250,000 a year? And it was something like 40%. I can't remember the number exactly. Something outrageous. Something like 20 times the actual level of people. They thought basically all these conservative voters are rich. And so, therefore, they're feathering their nests by trying to weaken Obamacare or to reform the tax code. That's nuts. It's more like 2%. And then they ask conservatives, what percentage of liberal voters are LGBT or, you know, gay and lesbian? And it was some unbelievably elevated percentage, like 20. They thought like a quarter of those voters were LGBT. It's at most 6%. And so once again, that was because of the attribution of motive. They were getting the statistics wrong. That's really, really dangerous. It's bad for all of us not to expose ourselves to different kinds of people.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Arthur Brooks when we come back in just a moment. Hey, folks, here's some advice for anyone who sends emails to their customers. You deserve a better email marketing platform, one that's actually designed with your type of organization in mind. And unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first, offering powerful email marketing with a personal touch. With Emma, you'll have everything you need to connect your data, build your audience, and do your most successful marketing ever. Because their easy-to-use platform makes advanced functionality accessible to everyone on your team, no technical skills required. You can even connect Emma with the services you count on to run your business, like Salesforce and Google Analytics. Not to mention, Emma's award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more. So put the power of email experts behind your marketing. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma.com. Do you want to learn how to go from good to great to unstoppable? Do you want to maximize your potential? Do you see the value of networking with other ambitious professionals? If you answered yes, invest in yourself. Buy a ticket now to Relentless MV, a very unique event being held in Martha's Vineyard September 28th through 30th, featuring elite performers like David Goggins, Tim Grover, and the Iron Cowboy. Their speakers will share tips, tricks, and experiences to help you become unstoppable. The event is being held at Lambert's Cove Inn, a beautifully restored farmhouse from the 1700s nestled in the woods. This event promises a ton of fun and, more importantly, a great investment in your future. Both weekend and day passes are available. And as a listener of this podcast, you get a special deal. Use promo code KICK to receive $500 off. Visit RelentlessMV.com for more information. Again, that's RelentlessMV.com and promo code KICK for $500 off. Buy now. Limited tickets are available. With more of us spending our lives online than in real interactions with other human beings, and our social media so siloed, how do you break out of that echo chamber?
The way to do it is, the best advice I ever got was from my mom. It's a beautiful day. Get out of the house. I mean, it's just crazy how much time people spend on these just unproductive means of communication. People need to get out. Mm-hmm. Talk to other people, goof around. One of the things that I recommend to a lot of folks, because my main area of research going back to my days in academia, is happiness. I've been doing work on happiness for many, right, many years. And when it comes to politics, one of the things that I find is the greatest ideologues, they tend to be very unhappy because they're systematically getting worked up and angry again and again and again. Siloed behavior and anger in politics is a recipe for discontent and misery. So one of the things that I often recommend to people these days is a politics fast or a politics cleanse, where you take 2 weeks and you commit yourself to not watching any news about politics, not having any conversations about politics, except you know, Kick-Ass News and the Arthur Brooks Show, of course, and just making sure that you're not getting exposed to these ideas just for 2 weeks. I mean, you don't have to like go all the way through the election or, you know, become some sort of weird person who's totally uninformed. Just, you know, 10 days, 14, 15 days, just have at it, and a bunch of things become clear to people. It's just unbelievable. So one of the things that you find is that people become indignant at the exposure that they were having because they find out that they've been manipulated. They've been kind of terrorized by commercial forces that want to use them. People on their own side, they become annoyed and indignant at their own side because they realize that they've been kind of pawns in this war. They also find that politics in America is kind of like a Venezuelan soap opera. You know, you can watch it and then you can put it down for a couple of weeks and you can pick up and it's exactly where it left off. It's a whole, you know, really, wait, yeah, a minute, that character is still having an affair. You know, it's like Carlos is still having an affair with Sylvia. You know, it's like, well, mm-hmm, that's kind of the plot. The point is that nothing happens. That's kind of the way it's supposed to go. That's how politics work in this country. You put it down for a couple of weeks and you realize the third thing is that you have a lot more time on your hands and a lot more happiness, a lot more love, yeah, in your life, and people find you less objectionable. And man, who doesn't want that?
Well, I love this idea that you could actually put down politics for 2 weeks and then just pick up where you left off and not really have missed anything, because the media is very good at making it seem with this 24-hour news cycle that every half hour there's something that you're going to miss if you don't check your news feed or your tweets first thing in the morning when you wake
crazy
up.
It is crazy.
It's almost like we're trained now that way. Things that otherwise wouldn't be significant are elevated to a significant position. I mean, who cares how Melania Trump decorates the White House, if someone has a problem with that, or if someone gets snubbed on Twitter.
That's exactly right.
It has no bearing.
It has no bearing on anything. And, you know, it reminds me, back in the 50s, they used to do these experiments with monkeys, and where they would allow them to self-administer cocaine. And within 24 hours, you know, they would be doing nothing. They wouldn't be sleeping. They wouldn't be eating. They wouldn't be socializing. They would forego water. They would just sit in front of the cocaine machine and hit the lever over and over and over again until they died. That's social media. That's basically, so this is like the cocaine monkey culture of politics. You know, it's amazing when you talk to people who've developed political apps for the major newspapers even. The way that they design the apps is that after you read a particular story in op-ed, for example, there's a link after that that based on the discernment of your reading habits that takes you up a notch. So if you were at 3 on the intensity, the political intensity, it'll take you to a 5 in political intensity. What is it trying to do? It's trying to use your dopamine levels in your brain. It's trying to make you mad and to keep you addicted to it. Man, we are being used in this country. This is like the closest I ever come to a conspiracy theorist, is to say that there are vast moneyed interests in media, in this media complex dedicated to keeping us going, you know, keeping us at like cocaine monkey. And if you don't like being used, fight back. And the way to fight back is to say goodbye.
Yeah, and the professional polarizers, their stock in trade seems to be stoking moral outrage, which on the extreme end of things, that's an addiction in itself. It seems like people are getting way more amped up than they ever used to be. Americans are so quick to condemn another person, oftentimes even before they know all the facts about the situation. Talk about where this heightened moral outrage comes from, and particularly moral outrage as a way of virtue signaling.
Yeah, you know, an early guest on my podcast was Molly Crockett, who's at Yale and Oxford. She's a social psychologist, and she actually runs her own lab called the Crockett Lab. It's fascinating stuff because she talks about virtue signaling and moral outrage. And she basically says that people will use moral outrage to show that they have the right virtues. It's funny because in the world of social media, where everything has to be at 11, given the fact that we don't have human contact to moderate anything, if you're basically acting mellow on social media, it means you don't care. And if you don't care, it means you don't have any moral salience on a subject. So the result is that people have to go bonkers all the time to show that they're decent people. And this is especially true for a lot of young people on social media today. And so it's very disorienting. So you can say the dumbest little thing, you know, something that's relatively anodyne, not meant to be offensive at all, and then you become anathema on social media almost immediately. And, you know, that's actually incredibly unhealthy. Virtue signaling, you know, showing your pieties should come from being good, not from being crazy mad.
Right. And one thing that I found very interesting, there was a study that's shown that people actually respond better to virtue signaling that takes the form of a positive act of kindness, or what you and Abraham Lincoln would call the better angels of our nature, than they do to these pronouncements of moral outrage. If that's the case, why does moral outrage seem to be so much more prevalent? Or is it prevalent? Perhaps is it just that the negative virtue signaling gets amplified more than positive virtue signaling?
What happens is, you know, that's exactly correct. That people will perceive the morality of positive messages in a different in a better way than they do the negative stuff. But negative stuff gets amplified much, much more quickly. So that when you use intense language, and especially when you use negative intense language, there's a lot of studies on this in social media showing that your work will be propagated, your message will be propagated much faster and much wider. So once again, this gets back to the people who their goal is actually not persuasion. Their goal is certainly not a better, happier, moral society. Their goal is money and power and fame. And when you're going up against somebody whose whole goal is money and power and fame, and yours is, you know, goodness and happiness and virtue, you're going to be going about those two objectives in a different way. So you basically have what amounts to asymmetric warfare in the world of social media.
And in your efforts to foster better political discourse, you talk a lot about the science of how our brains process politics. And one thing that you brought up on one of the episodes of the Arthur Brooks Show, I thought was just such an excellent point. You talked about this paradox of how people get way more worked up in a negative way about politics and stressed over things that don't directly affect them in any kind of a personal way.
Yeah.
We're far more outraged and upset over things that are much broader and intangible fears.
Yeah, no, that's right. And that's
how, how do such distant issues become emotional for us?
Yeah, no, it's weird. It would seem like it would be exactly the opposite. If something's far away from you, you should care less, not more. But what's really going on here is that there's a when things are close to you and you can affect them, they often will make you less worked up precisely because you can do something about them. It's the sense of impotence that drives people crazy. The fact that they're being bombarded with irrelevant information, but irrelevant information that touches on their moral schemes, on the, you know, the things that seem really, really outrageous and wrong, they can't do anything about. So they try to do the best they can, which is express themselves in the most ideologically extreme and vitriolic terms on social media. So that's the reason that we get that. People are lashing out because they feel they don't have any control.
And a lot of the problem is someone's political position gets taken as a direct attack on them as a human being. Does the fault there lie with the receiver or the giver of information? How do you have a productive, issue-driven conversation with someone who's going to take everything personally?
Yeah, take everything personally or attack personally. And so personalization is one of the great scourges of political culture today. And people who want to break that cycle, the way to do it is to not participate in it. We hear it constantly. You know, you get on to, and part of this is just pure ad hominem. When you say something, nobody takes it on its, people frequently don't take it on its face, but rather they'll attribute a motive to you. Say, I know why you're saying that. It's just because you don't want to pay taxes. And the reason you don't want to pay taxes is you only care about yourself and you don't care about the poor. As a matter of fact, you hate the poor. That's pure ad hominem argumentation and personal attack. And so the natural tendency is to get super defensive. And when somebody takes something very, very personally and they say, you know, anything that you say is taken as evidence that you're a bigot, that you're a discriminator, it becomes almost impossible to have a productive conversation. So here's the technique for fighting back against this. And, you know, we got a lot of people I know. You have a lot of people who listen to you on college campuses. So what can you do so you can have a productive conversation in a way that doesn't devolve into this, or at least see a way to pivot away from this really unproductive form of communication? Number one, rule number one, don't be a jerk. Number one is to not actually, don't offend people. Don't be a bigot. Don't be a discriminator. Think about the love that you actually should have for all different kinds of people. Diversity is the true strength of this country. People living together from all different backgrounds, from all different countries, from all different points of view and kinds of experiences, the reason that America is the greatest country in the world and everybody still wants to come here. So don't screw that up by doing things that are actually objectively going to offend people. So rule number one is don't do harm. Rule number two is when somebody is unreasonable in the way that they take offense or attribute bad motives to you, is to use that as an opportunity to answer that charge with kindness. Never be defensive. Defensiveness is always totally unproductive. There's never a good reason for you to be defensive when somebody treats you poorly. When somebody treats you poorly, you should stop and you should close your eyes and you should say, thank you, this is my opportunity, and return it with gratitude and with a smile and with kindness, and guaranteed you'll change a heart. Maybe it's only your own, but there's also a fighting chance you're going to change the tenor of the conversation and be a force for good because you've inflected away from vitriol. You've inflected away from bitterness.
And you talk a lot about the science of political persuasion and how people change their minds. What does it take for a person with deeply held beliefs to change their mind on one of these controversial or contentious issues?
Most people don't. Okay. But what they can do is soften their position. So, again, that should be the goal. If you have a really, really strong view on something and you believe it's based in facts and you believe it's completely right and somebody disagrees with you, the goal shouldn't be within a 45-minute conversation or 3-hour Thanksgiving dinner or an interaction, God forbid, on social media to make them say, he's right. I'm completely wrong on this. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of stupid. That's an unrealistic goal. It's not even the right goal to hold. It's to soften somebody so that they're more interested in another position on the issue. And that is totally achievable. But the way that you do it is apostolically. The way that you do it is by showing that you're the kind of person who has goodwill. And that actually starts with listening to somebody's point of view, again, with kindness and without defensiveness.
And a lot of what you're saying would sound to most people like couples counseling. And you actually brought a guest on who I believe he was a psychologist who specializes in helping couples work together and communicate their differences better. Do the same rules that might apply to couples quarrels apply to political debate?
Yeah, so you're referring to the guest I had was John Gottman. He's he started the Gottman Institute with his wife Julie. They've been married for a long time, and he's a president. He's the president of that institute, but also a professor at the University of Washington in Seattle. And this is a guy I've been a huge fan of for a super long time. His institute is dedicated to people who are married to each other, loving each other for the rest of their lives. I mean, what is not to like about that? This guy's a hero. Yeah. He's brought literally thousands of couples back from divorce court before it was too late. And his whole set of techniques is around communicating with each other, positivity, and avoiding not anger, because anger is fine. You know, anger is literally uncorrelated with divorce and separation. It's when you mix disgust with anger, you get something called contempt. Eye rolling, mockery, sarcasm, sneering, disdain.
Right.
That stuff is really, really super dangerous. So his whole thing is to avoid contempt and to listen more. And I pressed him on this because he's never actually done anything on politics. And I said, look, I'm bringing together the world's greatest marriage counselor to bring America back together. So I need rules, man. I need rules. And so if you listen to that episode, it ends up with John Gottman's four rules or how to bring America back together again. I'm not going to give it away because, you know, it's really worth listening to the whole episode. John Gottman, he's the master. I mean, guaranteed.
Yeah, it was really
good.
He's
great, right?
Yeah, I highly recommend people listen to that one. And I'm not going to give away any of those four rules, but I will say this. One thing that was fascinating to me is he actually said that the human immune system becomes compromised by contempt.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that.
Yeah, for sure. And so contempt, again, is this anger mixed with disgust. And disgust is the noxious ingredient. Anger's fine as long as it's not used in a destructive way. But when you mix in the disgust, it's kind of like mixing in ammonia with bleach. It turns into this combustible thing that can actually kill you. In this case, it would kill relationships because it drives a permanent wedge between people. And in so doing, you know, given the fact that there's all kinds of literature on the physiological impacts of the end of love, you know, people live longer, they live better, they live with greater health when they love each other, when they have a good relationship with their family and they have a ton of friends and they have happy marriages. And so anything that ends love, anything that drives people apart is going to wind up hurting health and making people die earlier. I mean, again, I hate to sound extreme about this, but the current climate that we have in this country that's being fostered by these interests, this is literally physically bad for us.
Well, among the culprits for this, in addition to the polarizing media and the siloing of social media, another one you talk about is this chilling effect that we've seen on university campuses. As someone who spent a large part of your life in academia before coming to AEI, is this something that you've experienced yourself?
Actually not very much in my own life, and I'm very grateful for that. But there have been a lot of cases that we've seen of people being shut down on college campuses. And the main reason is because there's been a movement in campuses on the so-called deplatforming, which is to take away people's ability to speak. And a lot of that comes from a very, very new way of thinking, which is to say that when people offend you or they hurt your feelings or they say something that you find offensive, that's actually a form of violence. So the way a lot of people that grew up in my generation, I'm in my mid-50s now, and people in my generation would say there's a huge difference between speech and action. And so speech can't be violence.
Yeah.
But a lot of this new thinking on college campuses is that speech is a form of violence. And therefore, since you were against violence, we should shut down offensive speech. A lot of that has been from provocateurs and controversialists on college campuses who come simply to offend. But in many cases, it's been as well actual scholars, a lot of them on the political right. I've been very fortunate and people have treated me with real kindness and respect. I love academia, by the way. I mean, the reason I care about this in the first place is because academia has always been the home where my heart is. My dad was a college professor. My grandfather was a college professor. I was a college professor. And so I think this is the center of the competition of ideas. It's the ferment that can really save America. But this is a little bit, it's not a permanent threat, but I think it is a threat today that we all need to take seriously, to listen to each other more and to rebel against the idea of deplatforming anybody.
Before we go, you recently announced your intention to retire as president of the American Enterprise Institute after, I think, 10 years there.
Yep.
Have you thought much about what you want to do in this next chapter?
Yeah, I mean, it's 10 years is a long time to run a think tank, and I think that it's a good idea for people to step back after a decade from almost any chief executive job. My problem is that I actually published on this subject when I was still teaching at Syracuse, and I had never been a chief executive. I said, you know, like, I got the data, man, and you shouldn't stay more than a decade, and I wrote that and published it. It makes it a little bit tricky for me to say, actually, I meant 20. So, you know, 10 years came, and it was time for me to take my own advice. So what I'm dedicated to for the rest of my life is building the movement, is the building a movement that can truly bring Americans together. You know, I believe that this is the United States is the greatest hope for the world. I mean, we have set the world free. What a gift it has been. The American leadership around the world, the American free enterprise system, based on this idea that global leadership should come from aspiration and hope, especially pushed out to the periphery of society. I mean, this crazy country built by total riffraff outsiders has come to actually be an inspiration to the whole world. We cannot permit this country to be torn apart. So I'm dedicated to building a movement. I don't know if it's social. I don't know if it's political. I don't know exactly what form it's going to take yet. But Ben, I'm in this fight for the rest of my life. We got to make love cool again in this country.
Yeah, we'll keep fighting the good fight. Certainly, there's no happier warrior than you, Arthur. Where can people subscribe to the Arthur Brooks Show?
Anywhere fine podcasts can be found. So okay. Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, any of the good places, you'll actually find the Arthur Brooks Show. And it's picking up steam. If people listen to it, I'll be really grateful. But more importantly, please give it a rating, whether you like it or even if you don't.
Absolutely. Go hit subscribe and review. Arthur Brooks, thanks so much for talking with me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Ben.
Thanks again to Arthur Brooks for coming on the podcast. Again, I highly recommend you subscribe to his podcast, The Arthur Brooks Show, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Visit the American Enterprise Institute at aei.org and follow Arthur on Twitter at Arthur Brooks. If you're on the fence about life insurance, get down with Ladder. Ladder is the smart, easy way to get and manage life insurance. Just go online and apply. It only takes a few minutes. With Ladder, there's no paperwork or fees, and you can change it anytime without penalties. Ladder is licensed and backed by trusted partners with billions in coverage. Go to ladderlife.com and get off the fence about getting life insurance. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.